what are our expectations of the Christian life? Some of us are naive. We think that if we work hard, and we balance that by carving out time for rest and leisure, and we make wise decisions, then we can expect our lives to go pretty smoothly and pretty enjoyably. And maybe not right now, but just after this busy patch. Ecclesiastes says to the naive, be realistic. Since sin entered the world in what we call the fall, the world has been radically broken. We can't understand life. We can't control life. We can't expect life to go smoothly. That is true for believers as well as for unbelievers. If you're not yet following Jesus this morning and some well-meaning Christian has told you that doing so will make your problems go away, you need to know that's not true, not in this life. When we trust in Jesus, God instantaneously frees us from the penalty for our sin, but he only gradually frees us from the power of sin in our lives. And it's not until Jesus welcomes us into the new creation that we'll be freed from the presence of sin and all our problems will go away. Life in this fallen world will always be frustrating, disappointing, and unsatisfying. We must not be naive, but realistic. Some of us, by contrast, are cynical. Work's a curse, and there's never anything good on TV, and even when we think we've made wise decisions, life doesn't seem to go any more smoothly or particularly enjoyably. And so all we can hope for is that we'll die soon and go to heaven. And Ecclesiastes says to the cynic, look for the good in what God has given you. Yes, the new creation will be much, much better than this one, and we are to long for it. But our lot in this life is from the hand of our good Creator God, and therefore we need to train ourselves to look for the good in what God has given us. The preacher, perhaps King Solomon, tells us three things in the first two chapters. The world is transient and repetitive. There is nothing to be gained under the sun, and therefore look for the good in what God has given you. So first of all, the world is transient and repetitive. Chapter 1, verse 1. Look at it with me. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. One of the preacher's favorite words, this word vanity. It's literally a mist or a breath. Some of the time it seems to mean kind of futile, pointless. Some of the time it's often just closer to temporary or transient. A mist is hard to get hold of, and it's gone before you've got used to it being there. Life in this fallen world is transient. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. One generation makes the historic decision to join the European Union, and the next makes the historic decision to leave it. And we're back where we started. The earth is an unchanging stage, but each self-important generation of humanity has little more than a walk-on, walk-off role. Life is transient. And life is repetitive. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes round to the north, round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. Sun, wind, water, they all look like they're headed somewhere, but the reality is that they're going in circles. And we may believe in the inexorable progress of liberal democratic values, for better or worse. But on the longer time scale, the reality is that humanity is going in circles. Verse 8, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it said, see, this is new? It has been already. in the ages before us. I'm promised that when they eventually finish untangling the tracks, whatever that means, at London Bridge Station, my commute will be quicker and more reliable than ever before. What progress! But since it was opened in 1836, London Bridge Station has required rebuilding or major modifications in 1842, 1844, 1850, 1854, 1862, 1928, 1941, 1978, and the 1990s. The current work isn't going to finally fix everything. It is just the latest patching up in a world that falls apart. It'll soon need doing again. There is no progress to get excited about. Verse 11, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. How many generations back can you name the occupations of your ancestors? My great-great-grandfather presumably got up early and went to work and sweated away every day for 50 years. But I don't know what he did for a living. If not now, then pretty soon there won't be a soul on earth who knows what he did with all that time. Verse 14, I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. There's nothing we can do about the situation, and it's foolish to try. This fallen world and our efforts in it are transient and repetitive. In Romans chapter 8, verse 20, the Apostle Paul is talking about the fall recorded in Genesis chapter 3, but he deliberately uses the language of Ecclesiastes when he talks about it. Because of human sin, he says, the creation was subjected to futility. And that is the same word that the ancient Greek translations of Ecclesiastes use for vanity. The creation was subjected to futility, to vanity. The whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now, says Paul. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. In the new creation, it won't be like this. But in this creation, it will. Creation is groaning. We, as someone has written, are either groaning or pretending that we're not. Of course, this isn't the whole truth. But isn't it a relief to admit that it is part of the truth? To stop pretending that we're not groaning. If you feel that life is transient and repetitive, be reassured. That is what the Bible leads us to expect. The preacher's first conclusion is that the world is transient and repetitive. And his second conclusion follows. There is nothing to be gained under the sun, that is, in this life. There is nothing to be gained under the sun. That was the preacher's rhetorical question in verse 3. What does man, back in chapter 1, verse 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? And the answer is nothing. We climb the mountain, but there's nothing at the top. Toil has the general sense there of sort of everything we pursue in life. And he picks out three such things for further examination. First of all, toil in the narrower sense of work. And he says this, toil brings no gain. Our toil, our paid employment, the work of managing a home or whatever it is, and that toil isn't achieving anything lasting for us. It's not a means to some lasting end. As we saw in 1 Timothy chapter 6 last week, we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of the world. And so we're obliged to leave the results of our toil to others. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2 verse 18 where he picks up this toil idea again. Chapter 2 verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who'll come after me. And who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labours under the sun. Because sometimes a person who's toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. So you get the filing system beautifully arranged, you go off on maternity leave, and the fool who replaces you doesn't know one end of the alphabet from the other. What have you achieved? You work hard and save well and leave it to your children, and they blow it. What have you achieved? And the answer is nothing. Toil brings no gain. It's not that there's no value to our work. We're going to see that work is a good gift from God. We can take pleasure in doing it. But the preacher says, don't view work as a means to some more significant end. Some people work in order to feel valuable. But then we've never done enough. And others work in order to enjoy the weekend. But those weekends start to feel shorter and shorter. Others work in order to retire. But from the veranda of your holiday home, won't it seem a bit odd if you ruined the best 50 years of your life devoted to saving money in order to spend the last 10 years of your life desperately trying to stay healthy enough to enjoy spending it? Have you really gained anything from all that work? Some of us are lucky enough to have paid employment that we basically love. I love my job. But that is rare. It's a recent idea. I think it is a dangerous one. That there is out there a career for each of us, and where we'll get to do the thing that we love, and someone will pay us to do it. Why would you think that? Be realistic. If you can get someone to pay you to do the thing you love, of course, do it. I'm not trying to stop you. But most people don't have a career that fulfills. Most people make do with a job that pays the bills. So if that is what you feel you've got, be reassured. And that is what the Bible leads us to expect. Toil brings no gain in this transient and repetitive world. What about pursuing pleasure? No, the pursuit of pleasure brings no gain. That's in chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. The preacher tries a little experiment, and his summary is in the first verse of chapter 2. Look at it with me. I said in my heart, come now, I'll test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. We won't read the following verses, but he tries wine and works, great home and garden renovations, and wealth and women. He insists that he didn't abandon his wisdom, so don't think of sort of students pursuing drink and drugs and sex. And for a king in that culture, these are relatively respectable pursuits, but it is the pursuit of personal pleasure. And in verse 11, he concludes the way he started. Verse 11, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Pleasure is a wonderful thing to experience, but it turns out that it's a terrible thing to pursue. I read of an actress recently who had decided that rather than working, the next phase of her life would be devoted to pursuing her own well-being. She was going to focus on herself and doing the things that brought her pleasure. Well, the preacher's tried that, and he would tell her that this phase of her life will not bring her the satisfaction that she's looking for. The preacher doesn't say that the pursuit of pleasure didn't bring him any pleasure. In fact, he says that it did. But it didn't bring him any gain. The pursuit of pleasure didn't achieve anything beyond itself. It's vanity, a mist that disappears. The pleasure of reading a gripping novel makes you want to get to the end. But when you get to the end, the pleasure of reading ends too, and you wish there were more pages. The pursuit of pleasure will, of course, bring some pleasure, but it doesn't achieve anything beyond itself. It brings no lasting, ultimate gain. That is the nature of life in this transient, repetitive world. Toil brings no gain. The pursuit of pleasure brings no gain. Perhaps most surprisingly, the preacher says that wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. Wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. Look at chapter 2, verse 12 with me. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what's already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there's more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then am I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there's no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies, just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after wind. Now, wisdom in the Bible is not mostly an intellectual thing, it's a moral thing. That means living life in line with God's revealed will in the Bible, going God's way. And the preacher says that, all things considered, it is better to be wise than foolish. Verse 13, there is more gain in wisdom than in folly. The book of Ecclesiastes doesn't contradict the book of Proverbs, which tells us that living God's way in God's world will often work better. Now, if you live life with your eyes in your head, as the preacher puts it, and of course, you're going to avoid some of the potholes that the fool walking in darkness is going to fall into. For example, don't gamble, and it's easier to avoid falling into debt. But if we think that by wise living we can manipulate God into making our life turn out nice, we're badly mistaken. 1 Timothy chapter 6 again warns us about false teachers who imagine that godliness is a means of gain. No, verse 14, wise or fool, the same event happens to all of them, particularly death. Verse 16, how the wise dies, just like the fool. So the wise who get their 5 a day, or is it 10, may on average live longer than the fools who eat only bacon. Wisdom brings gain, but they all die. Wisdom brings only limited gain. In fact, there are some downsides to being wise. Chapter 1, verse 18. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So the wise spends his long life worrying about whether kale or cabbage is the more super of the foods, and probably smells of them both. But the fool lives a short life of blissful ignorance about such things, and dies with a taste of bacon on his lips. And wisdom brings sorrow. Perhaps you're finding even this morning that this sermon is causing you vexation and sorrow. Do check that what I'm saying really is what Ecclesiastes is saying, but if so, then I'm afraid this is the sorrow that comes from growing in wisdom. It may feel like grieving a death to give up the naive belief that the world's wonderful and life's a treat. But the preacher would urge us to embrace the truth about this fallen world, not only because it's true, but also because, as we'll see, it frees us to take what joy we can from life in this world. And it keeps us looking forward to the greater, deeper, lasting joy of the world to come. In this world, wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. Sometimes we may be doing all the right things, living wisely, not perfectly, but wisely. And yet things don't seem to go any more smoothly than they do for those who have no interest in pleasing Jesus. If that's your experience of life in this world, be reassured. That is what the Bible leads us to expect. In this transient, repetitive, fallen world, there is nothing to be gained, not through toil or the pursuit of pleasure. Even wisdom makes practically no difference to how our lives will go now or what we will have at the end of them. But, in Del Ralph Davis's words, the preacher is not a cynical old goat who drank Drano and vinegar for breakfast. His third conclusion is a wonderfully positive message. He says, look for the good in what God has given you. Look for the good in what God has given you. Some of the time life is going to feel rubbish. Several times the preacher says things like, I hated life, or I hated my job. We're going to have days like that. But that doesn't need to be the sum of our experience in this world. First, we have to accept that our lot in this life, the bits we like and the bits that we don't, comes from the hand of God. So, for example, talking about negative things, in chapter 1, verse 13, the preacher says, it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. We have to train ourselves to see everything in life, not as the result of blind fate or retributive karma. No, everything that comes our way is the gift of a good and loving and incomprehensible God. We don't expect to understand why he's given us this particular lot in life instead of that one, but it is never because he is withholding things that would be good for us. And this side of the cross, we can be even clearer about that than the preacher was. So Romans chapter 8, 32, he who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? We are to train ourselves to see everything in our lives as a gift from God. And we are to train ourselves to look for the good in those gifts. So look at chapter 2, verse 24. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? The ability to enjoy God's good gifts is another of God's good gifts. But it's also an active decision for us to make. That expression, to find enjoyment in his toil, is literally to make his soul see good in his toil. This is the discipline recommended nowadays, even by the secular world. Forbes magazine recently recommended keeping a gratitude journal in order to count your blessings, and promised 7 scientifically proven benefits to your physical and mental health if you do so. I'm not clear who you're supposed to thank if you don't believe in God, yourself perhaps. But Christians know that good things come from God in order that we might enjoy them. 1 Timothy chapter 6 again. We're not to set our hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. Toil brings no gain beyond itself, so don't work in order to achieve retirement. Make your soul see good in the work itself. In chapter 2, verse 10, the preacher says, "My heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil." So if you spent the morning compiling a spreadsheet, don't worry too much about whether it's a spreadsheet that's going to change the world. Just take some pleasure from the fact that it's a very nice, neat, tidy spreadsheet. You've done it well. The rows alternate between pale blue and pale yellow, and that looks really nice. Your good and loving God has given you that spreadsheet to work on. And there is something good about it if you'll train yourself to look for it. The pursuit of pleasure brings no gain. So don't hoard your annual leave as though if you can only find enough time to focus on your personal well-being, the frustrations of life will disappear. But that doesn't mean that we can't take pleasure in pleasure. I enjoy that glass of wine with dinner from time to time. And when the sun rises over the misty fields, take a moment to enjoy God's beautiful creation. Make your soul see the good in what God has given you. Wisdom brings only limited gain and sorrow with it. So don't start thinking that if you can only get holy enough, then suddenly life will start going smoothly. But it's still better to be wise than foolish. We can make our souls see good in living life God's way. We mustn't be naive. This world is terribly broken by human sin, and therefore we cannot understand life. We cannot control life. And we cannot expect life to go smoothly. But the answer is not to become cynical. No, when we give up viewing toil, the pursuit of pleasure, or even wisdom as means to some greater end, as things that might achieve for us some lasting gain, that frees us up to take what pleasure we can from those things. And there is much joy to be found in life in this world if we will train ourselves to look for the good in the things that God has given us. And better still, the sin that has broken this world has been dealt with on the cross by Jesus. If we will trust in him, then we can instantaneously be freed from the penalty for sin, gradually freed from the power of sin in our lives, and one day be freed from the very presence of sin. The world is groaning, and Christians don't have to pretend that they're not. But Christians groan in eager expectation of the perfect new world to come, a world of unmitigated joy in knowing Jesus and his people and the good things that he's given us.